top secret plan for the unlawful expansion of domestic intelligence gathering activities by the FBI, the CIA, and military intelligence units. The president had authorized government agencies to conduct break-ins, surreptitious entries, illegal wiretaps, mail surveillance, and a program of spying and infiltration directed at the anti-Vietnam War movement in the cities and on the campuses. The author of the plan, former White House aide Tom Charles Houston, had warned that elements of the program were clearly illegal. Still, the president had approved it in writing in 1970. Then he had canceled it, also in writing, 4 or 5 days later. Buzzard guessed correctly that some agencies had disregarded instructions to return their copies of the plan after it was canceled. He found 2 copies and took 1 to the president. Instead of being upset, Nixon was relieved. The press had been speculating that Dean's documents linked Haldeman and Ehrlichman to the cover-up, and that Dean might even have something that involved the president. Now, at least, he knew what he had to face, Nixon said. Buzzard soon learned of another peril facing the president. A Senate Appropriations Subcommittee, riding herd on the Central Intelligence Agency's budget, wanted Lieutenant General Vernon Walters, Deputy Director of the CIA, to supply highly classified memoranda he had drafted after his conversations with Haldeman and Ehrlichman concerning the Watergate investigation. Walters asked Buzzard whether the memos could be withheld on grounds of executive privilege. Send them over, Buzzard said, and he'd check. One memo was a summary of a conversation at the White House on June 23, 1972, among Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Walters, and CIA Director Richard M. Helms, just 6 days after the Watergate burglary. Buzzard read, Haldeman said the bugging affair at the Democratic National Headquarters at the Watergate apartments had made a lot of noise, and that the Democrats were trying to maximize it. The investigation was leading to a lot of important people, and this could get worse. He asked what the connection with the agency was, and the director repeated that there was none. Haldeman said that the whole affair was getting embarrassing, and it was the president's wish that Walters call on FBI Acting Director L. Patrick Gray and suggest to him that since the 5 suspects had been arrested, this should be sufficient, and that it was not advantageous to have the inquiry pushed, especially in Mexico, etc. Buzzard understood the reference to Mexico. $89,000 in Nixon campaign money had been laundered through Mexico before it landed in the bank account of one of the Watergate burglars. On June 23, 1972, this Mexican connection was still unknown to the FBI. If, as it did later, the Bureau made the connection, the Nixon campaign committee could be tied to the financing of Watergate. It was the president's wish. The phrase troubled Buzzard. It tied the president to an order that seemed intended to throw the FBI off the track. Buzzard was worried. General Walters was no John Dean, he knew. Walters had neither an axe to grind nor an ass to save. As a young Army colonel, Walters had been Vice President Richard Nixon's translator on foreign trips. Nixon had appointed him as deputy director of the CIA to make sure that he had a friend high in the agency. Buzzard read the memo again. It was clear enough. He asked to see the president. He expected that Nixon would tell him that Walters was mistaken, or that Haldeman was so accustomed to doing things in the president's name that he had acted on his own authority. National security, Nixon told Buzzard straight away. That was the basis of the directive. He freely acknowledged that he himself had issued it. He said that he had done so to ensure that no CIA operations would be compromised. It had nothing to do with political consequences of the Mexican connection, the president insisted. He intimated that something about the Bay of Pigs operation may have figured in his decision. Buzzard was skeptical, but he didn't press the point with the president. The memo stated explicitly that political considerations were the basis of the order. Besides, not one of the other Walters Memcons, as the memos of conversations were called, mentioned national security. Should the memos be given to the Senate subcommittee? Buzzard asked. Take them up and give them to the committee, the president replied. He seemed confident that there was a national security justification for the order, though it escaped Buzzard. Buzhardt had been the president's special counsel on Watergate for less than a week, and he was trying to coordinate a response to challenges that were flying at them from all sides. He found it hard to share the president's confidence. The president consistently underestimated the dangers posed by a small army of government investigators and reporters who were bent on prying into the innermost secrets of his White House. For example, the FBI's acting director, William D. Ruckelshaus, had ordered a thorough inquiry into reports that had been appearing in the press and denied for months by his predecessor, L. Patrick Gray III and Ron Ziegler, that the administration had wiretapped reporters and White House aides to track down news leaks. On May 14th, Ruckelshaus announced that his agents had discovered records of 17 such taps in John Ehrlichman's White House safe. Increasingly worried, Buzhardt and Haig sought each other's counsel. Charges were escalating. Too much was out of control. Neither man knew whether the president was innocent or guilty.
"I'll help the guy," Buzhardt told Haig, "but I'm not about to go to jail for him."
Haig concurred. They could protect themselves if they trusted each other totally, but no one else. Haig had known the president for 4 years. He had spent hundreds of hours in conversation with Kissinger that turned, directly or indirectly, on the Nixon personality. Kissinger was intimately familiar with what he considered the vulgar strands of the Nixon psyche. The president was a man consumed by memories of past failures, a man who let his enemies dictate to him, whose actions were often reactions, Kissinger said. Nixon tried to fool even those closest to him, even Kissinger. He kept things from him. He was isolated, secretive, paranoid, Kissinger had always told Haig. Haig was never sure whether Kissinger was describing himself or Nixon. The general had disliked living in Kissinger's shadow, and Nixon had noticed that and made use of it. The president had reached over Kissinger to Haig many times during his first administration. He had sent him to Vietnam as his personal emissary about a dozen times to see what was really going on there, had made him his principal advisor on troop withdrawal, on strategic alternatives, all this somewhat independent of Kissinger. Nixon liked Haig's tough talk about pinkos and peaceniks and those queer, soft, left-leaning eggheads who went to Harvard and couldn't be counted on to storm the trenches in Asia. The president made derogatory comments about Kissinger to Haig, complaining about the professor's paranoia and his excessive concern with his own image. Privately, he had requested that Haig report on Kissinger's work, and the general had complied. It had been a confusing, often untenable position. But now Haig was not required to balance off his loyalties between two superiors. He was the president's principal deputy. Nixon had appealed to him on clear and precise grounds. Patriotism, respect for the presidency, trust, the conviction that the president of the United States needed him. Only Haig could help him lead the nation out of this nightmare, the president implied. Haig was committed. He would serve, and he would do his best. Much of Buzhardt's knowledge of Nixon came from his ex-boss at the Pentagon, former Defense Secretary Melvin R. Laird. Laird saw Nixon as a stage manager. The president would not deal directly with people or events. He preferred papers, memos, didn't talk back, didn't push him. Laird had told Buzhardt that he always had the feeling that the president didn't want any one person to have the full picture. No one was ever to be given the entire story. With matters thus arranged, the president could counter any argument by hinting that only he had the necessary facts and background. Nixon's strange methodology made timid ministers, Laird had said. Who would confront a president in the full awareness that he had been dealt out of essential information? But Buzhardt, too, was committed now. He would serve and do his best.
The biggest problem here is credibility, Haig told him.
The president's new team would meet matters head-on. They would launch a counteroffensive. Buzhardt was pleased. Throughout Watergate, he firmly believed, Nixon's mistake had been a failure to move off the defensive, to seize the issues and shake them to death. Buzzard and Haig wanted finally to get ahead of the problem, meet the current charges, anticipate future ones, answer them all, right now. The barrage of half-truths and speculation was devastating. The general and the lawyer went to the president. Haig did the talking. A final and definitive statement that dealt with the major allegations, both direct and implied, should be drafted, he said. It would have to stand for all time. It was essential that the statement be consistent with anything that might surface. The president said he was willing to let them give it a try. This would be the new team's first major effort. But they couldn't do it alone. They needed the members of the old White House team, who might have some information and some influence with the president. That would include Garment. It would be good to have the House liberal in on this, and Nixon's two principal speechwriters, Raymond K. Price, Jr. and Patrick J. Buchanan, who were regarded by the president as respectively the heart and the soul of his administration. Price, a 43-year-old Yale graduate who had worked for Collier's Magazine, Life, and the New York Herald Tribune, was the idealist and gentle theoretician. Buchanan, 35, a conservative former editorial writer for the St. Louis Globe-Democrat who had signed up with Nixon in 1966, was the hard political realist, the gut fighter, the resident expert in media manipulation. Time was short, Buzzard knew. The Senate Watergate Committee's hearings were scheduled to begin on May 17th. Four separate matters had to be met head-on, and reasons found to explain the president's actions. A rationale had to be offered for, one, the approval of the Houston plan authorizing illegal intelligence gathering, two, the wiretapping of administration aides and of reporters, three, the directive to the CIA to keep the FBI from investigating the Mexican money connection as stated in the Walters Memcon, four, the presence of the plumbers unit in the White House, E. Howard Hunt Jr., a former CIA agent, and G. Gordon Liddy, a former FBI agent, both convicted in the Watergate case, had been plumbers. Their role in the Ellsberg break-in had also to be explained. The president was not very cooperative, Buzzard and the others discovered very quickly. He did not wish to sit down with Haig or Buzzard or anybody else and offer his version of events. He told Buzzard to draft the best defense he could and bring it back for review. The process was excruciating. Slowly, Buzzard started piecing something together. Though the president always seemed ready or even eager to review his lawyer's work, he never volunteered anything to Buzzard, never offered to tell him what had actually happened. Buzzard would bring a set of postulates to him, and the president would respond, "That's wrong, try it again." Hide and seek. Buzzard wanted to wrap up the wiretaps, the plumbers, and the Walters Memcons in a national security blanket. Approval of the Houston plan would be acknowledged and would be cast as a response to a wave of violence, arson, and bombing in the cities and on the campuses in 1970. Buzzard and Garment were reasonably certain that the president had authorized the Ellsberg break-in, even though he still denied it. Buzzard thought they might yet dredge up legitimate national security grounds, but the others resisted the idea of even suggesting that the president had approved the break-in. If they dared take such a suggestion to Nixon, he would certainly fly into a rage. Buzzard persisted, though, and wrote it into a draft which admitted that Nixon had authorized the break-in for national security reasons, justified by the dangers that release of the Pentagon Papers posed to the president's efforts to bring peace in Vietnam with honor. The admission had a bold and confessional quality. It recalled to Buzzard the way President Kennedy had absorbed the responsibility for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Everyone else was sure Buzzard wouldn't dare take the draft to the president, but he did. The president read it. "I like the theory," he said calmly, "but the thing is that I didn't do it." Buzzard cut out that part of the draft. Now the group turned to Walter's memcons about the June 23 conversation and about other discussions that had taken place at the White House in the week following the Watergate break-in. Buchanan searched the memos for any hint, any veiled reference about national security. He couldn't find one. Buchanan had never maintained in private that the president was nearly so ignorant of the cover-up as he claimed. but it was the job of the prosecutors to prove otherwise, not his own, Buchanan reasoned. Still, this matter was especially troubling. The Walters memcons were not the kind of thing to trifle with. Walters is a goddamn memory expert, for Christ's sake, Buchanan exploded. He can listen to a guy talk for 10 minutes and then give it back word for word in French. Price was also skeptical. He could see how Nixon might have thought, then and now, that national security was at stake when in fact it wasn't, strictly speaking. The president had always discussed the Watergate revelations with Price in the context of his own national security responsibilities. Buzzard was disturbed. He went back to the president. National security, Nixon reiterated. Where? How? What? The president didn't respond directly. National security was sufficient. It had to do. He instructed Buzzard to make the statement broad. Buzzard and Buchanan drafted another paragraph, which Nixon finally accepted. It seemed to me possible that, because of the involvement of former CIA personnel in the Watergate break-in, and because of some of their apparent associations, this investigation could lead to the uncovering of covert CIA operations totally unrelated to the Watergate break-in. Buzzard then asked the president for some particulars. The president wouldn't deal with this question, but he insisted on one point. With the exception of the Ellsberg break-in, Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy's work for the plumbers had been undertaken for legitimate purposes of national security. Slowly, Buzzard and Buchanan elicited what they felt had been Nixon's state of mind at the time. With the aid of Garment and Price, they fashioned another paragraph in the president's name. I wanted justice done with regard to Watergate, but in the scale of national priorities with which I had to deal, and not at that time having any idea of the extent of political abuse which Watergate reflected, I also had to be deeply concerned with ensuring that neither the covert operations of the CIA nor the operations of the Special Investigations Unit, plumbers, should be compromised. Therefore, I instructed Mr. Haldeman and Mr. Ehrlichman to see that this was personally coordinated between General Walters, the deputy director of the CIA, and Mr. Gray of the FBI. It was certainly not my intent, nor my wish, that the investigation of the Watergate break-in or of related acts be impeded in any way. Buchanan was not convinced, and insisted that Buzzard asked the president once more whether there had been any political considerations. It was the sixth time he had gone back. National security. There could be no mistake, the president said. Okay. Buzzard returned to Buchanan. That's what the man says, Pat. On May 22nd, a 4,000-word presidential statement was released to the press. Garment and Buzzard were assigned to appear to answer reporters' questions. The press corps became abusive and incessantly interrupted the two lawyers as they tried to answer. Garment was offended by the scene. It affronted his sense of refinement of what was civilized, courteous behavior. Even so, the reporters' questions were not very different from those that Buzzard had continually carried back to the president. When? Why? How? What reasons were there to believe that this statement would not be rendered as inoperative as all the others? Garment could only reply that neither the president nor the president's lawyers could know precisely what he had been told and precisely when he had been told it. The president had searched his mind and his notes. There is no fundamental difference between the situation of the president and any other individual who has to deal with problems of recollection of events and transactions many months removed, Garment explained. Garment left the briefing convinced that the 4,000-word statement was a disaster, not because anything was held back, but because the president had admitted to so much. Questionable wiretapping, a domestic intelligence plan that, to Garment's mind, was Hitlerian, the plumbers, a term and concept that should have come from a Broadway comedy, not the White House, and an obstruction of the early Watergate FBI probe for reasons steeped in mystery and in unconvincing claims of national security. A week passed, during which Garment was surprised that there was no call for impeachment. He could not comprehend the mildness of the reaction. Was the country so unaccustomed to candor from the White House that a reckless assertion of the truth, no matter how squalid, was welcomed for its openness rather than condemned for its content? Buchanan, for one, was now certain that the president could get away with almost anything. It was important now to dispose of the matter, to get Watergate behind them, to move on, he said. Buzzard was content. This statement would never have to be declared inoperative. Now it seemed that Watergate might soon be over, and Buzzard could get back to the Defense Department, where he retained his title as general counsel.
God damn the Washington Post! Ziegler shouted when the newspaper's Sunday edition of June 3rd was dropped on his desk.
The lead story was headlined, Dean Alleges Nixon Knew of Cover-Up Plan. It stated that Dean planned to testify under oath at the Senate's Watergate hearings, regardless of whether he is granted full immunity from prosecution, and he will allege that President Nixon was deeply involved in the cover-up. Dean intended to swear that he was present or received telephone calls on at least 35 occasions between January and April 1973, in which the cover-up was discussed with the president, the story said. All this was attributed, as usual, to reliable sources. Ziegler was sure that meant Dean and his lawyers. Dean's testimony, the article stated, would claim that the president had advance knowledge of the executive clemency offers and of payments of hush money to the Watergate conspirators.
Impossible! Absolutely impossible! Ziegler shouted at Judy Johnson and Diane Sawyer, two of his principal assistants. All right, go back and see why the president was meeting with Dean.
It was a tedious assignment. An enormous number of lists of meetings and phone calls had to be retrieved from the White House Archives office. No detailed records of the subjects of conversations between the president and his aides had been kept, so the meetings had to be approximately reconstructed through newspaper clippings from copies of the White House news summaries that Buchanan's office prepared daily and from handwritten notes that the president sometimes passed on to Haldeman or Ziegler. The record, pitifully incomplete, was assembled in a three-ring binder for Ziegler. It was Dean versus the president. At Camp David, Maryland, the presidential retreat that Dwight Eisenhower had named after his grandson, Nixon read the newspapers that Sunday and found much to distress him. The Post was reporting, "One of the strongest charges against Mr. Nixon that Dean has made to investigators refers to a meeting Dean said he had with Mr. Nixon shortly before the sentencing of the seven Watergate defendants March 23rd. Dean said that Mr. Nixon asked him how much the defendants would have to be paid to ensure their continued silence. Dean, the sources reported, maintains that he told Mr. Nixon the additional cost would be about $1 million, and Dean also claims that the president replied there would be no problem in paying that amount. The New York Times, also citing anonymous informants, said that one of its sources suggested that Mr. Dean may have tape-recorded some of his White House conversations during the January-April period in the White House. Everybody taped everybody else then, the source said. Dean did it himself. Before he left Camp David that afternoon, the president called Haldeman three times. At 4:18 p.m., his former chief of staff arrived at the White House to meet him. Haldeman stayed for nearly 2 hours. It was the 32nd time that the president and Haldeman had talked in the 5 weeks since Haldeman had resigned.
Chapter 3. Steve Bull looked and sounded like many other young men who joined the new Nixon administration in 1969. His trim, athletic physique and his conservative business suits gave him the confident appearance of the man sure of his purpose, exuding the can-do attitude of the Nixon team player. Bull was responsible for keeping the president on schedule, and he also served as his personal aide-de-camp. His friendly and easy manner with presidential visitors tempered the president's brusque and graceless style. Without the visibly fierce ambition of the other young men who had attached their fortunes to Richard Nixon, Bull was easy to trust, even for the suspicious Haldeman. When Haldeman's principal deputy, Alexander P. Butterfield, left the White House in February 1973 to become head of the Federal Aviation Agency, Bull had inherited many of his responsibilities for organizing the flow of papers to and from the president. At the same time, he took over responsibility for overseeing an incidental and minor White House routine, the presidential taping system. The existence of the taping system was perhaps the best and longest kept secret in the Nixon White House, known only to the president, Haldeman, Haldeman's aide Lawrence Higby, Butterfield, Bull, Ziegler, Butterfield's secretary, and the handful of Secret Service technicians who maintained it. Bull was aware of only one instance in which tapes had been taken from the vault in the Executive Office Building. On April 25, 1973, Haldeman had asked him to retrieve several reels that contained conversations between John Dean and the president. The president wanted Haldeman to review them. Haldeman seemed certain that the tapes would undermine Dean's statements to the Watergate prosecutors, that they would be Richard Nixon's salvation. Now, 6 weeks later, on June 4th, there came a second request from Nixon. On that morning, Bull had to come up with the tapes of Dean's conversations with the president during February, March, and April. Working from logs of the president's meetings and phone calls, he called Secret Service Supervisor Ray Zumwalt and asked for the appropriate reels. Then he cued and marked each tape. Though he was familiar with the voices, Bull had difficulty finding the required conversations, buried as they were in hours of tape on the large reels. At 10:05 a.m., he took the first tape into the president and explained to him how to operate the recorder. "Push the play button when you are ready to listen, sir. Depress the stop button when you are done or want to stop the machine, sir. And if you want to rewind the tape or replay a portion of it, push the stop button and then the rewind button. Okay, got that, sir?" The president was almost totally lacking in mechanical ability and was not well coordinated physically. After 4 years of handing out souvenir presidential favors of cufflinks, tie clasps, pens, and golf balls, Nixon still required assistance to open the cardboard boxes. Bull was accustomed to providing such help. Once, the president had called him in to open an allergy pill bottle, which Nixon had been struggling with for some time, the childproof type of bottle, with instructions saying, "Press down while turning." The cap had teeth marks on it, where Nixon had apparently tried to gnaw it open. At 10:16 on this Monday morning, the president turned to the tapes. He was pleased with what he heard, as Haldeman had predicted he would be. This was his ace in the hole. He had exact accounts, whereas Dean had primarily his recollection. Nixon, the lawyer, realized the potency of this weapon, especially if it was used to arm those who were to cross-examine Dean. Haig arrived at 11:58. As exhausting as the chore was for Nixon to listen to the tapes, it was necessary, Haig told him. Now they could take the son of a bitch on. They might even catch Dean in perjury. The president agreed, but "we do know we have one problem," he reminded Haig. "It's that damn conversation of March 21st. Dean and the president had discussed the blackmail demands of the Watergate burglars and the questions of whether Nixon should grant them executive clemency. "But I think we can handle that," Nixon said. "Haldeman would refute Dean's version in his testimony, and that would take care of that. He didn't even need to listen to that conversation. Haldeman had reviewed it and briefed him." Haig said it was good that the president had spent the morning listening to the record, good for his own peace of mind. The president worried, however. "As you know, we're up against ruthless people," he sighed. "Well, we're going to be in great shape now," Haig said, "'cause we're going to prepare." Perhaps, he suggested, there might come a time when they would want to release their version of events through Buzzard. "But Buzzard didn't know about the taping system," the president said. Haig reminded Nixon that Buzzard had learned that there was a taping capability, at least on the phones. Nixon was disturbed that Buzzard might know. "All right," he said. "No further. He shouldn't tell anyone. Let's just assume we goofed. If you get back to Buzzard, you tell him you had national security stuff." When the time came to issue the material through Buzzard, they could camouflage the source of information. Al, we can put out the story to the effect that he, Buzzard, has memcons, chronologies, telephone recordings, and all that sort of thing. Haig agreed. They were safe. They could put out a more complete version of the meetings and discredit Dean without revealing the taping system. Moreover, Haig suggested, Dean's threat was not all that great. He's an unstructured guy. Nixon went back to listen to some more tapes. He sighed again. This is hard work, but I've got to do it. And it's best for me to do it, too. Haig certainly didn't want to hear them himself. Only you, he told Nixon. Only you. The president listened all through the afternoon. At 6:04 p.m., Ziegler joined him, and they gloated about how much better prepared they were than Dean. He had no documentation. For whatever it's worth, Buzzard has been through Dean's files, and there ain't a goddamn thing in it, Nixon said. Ziegler had not expected anything. Dean had not seemed the disciplined sort who kept good records, he told the president. The president gave Ziegler a rundown on what he had heard on the tapes from notes he had taken. They agreed that Dean had told the president very little about the Watergate cover-up until March 21st, when he came in with the cancer in the heart of the presidency thing, Nixon remarked. The president and his press secretary exchanged reassurances. Everything that Dean had told the president was related to limiting the political damage that the Senate Watergate Committee might cause, not to obstructing the Watergate prosecution and trial. There's no cover-up in this, to this point, period, said the president. Not one talk of cover-up. That's right, Ziegler parroted. But as he reviewed his notes from a conversation on March 13th, the president seemed concerned. There's a feeling of it through here, he said. It was when Dean had told him that Haldeman's political aide, Gordon Strachan, knew about the Watergate wiretap. Still, the president gave himself the benefit of the doubt and dismissed the problem. What the hell is that? He asked rhetorically. Nixon read aloud from his notes what, in essence, Dean had told him on March 17th. He paused at the point where Dean said that he, the president's own counsel, was probably vulnerable to prosecution. Because I was over this like a blanket, Nixon quoted Dean. But I said, John, you didn't know about it. He said, that's right. I have no knowledge, no prior knowledge. The president seemed to ask Ziegler for reassurance. How does it strike you? He was telling me that there was a cover-up? Not at all, Ziegler assured him. There was more, and it was worse. The president continued reading from his notes. I said, we've got to cut that off. We can't have that go to Haldeman. But we just stopped right there. There was no... I suppose he could say there that I was telling him to cover up. Wouldn't you say, for Haldeman? I suppose he could say that in the context at the time that... Ziegler paused to clear his throat. Still, there's nothing. Nothing, Mr. President. It went on. As Nixon looked to Ziegler to confirm his innocence, Ziegler put the conversations with Dean in the best possible light. And you were talking about political problems, not illegal problems, Ziegler told his boss. Political problems as they related to the Irvin Committee hearings and what could come out in the course of those hearings. Damn it, I know that's the case. And those notes are proof, he said, referring to the lined sheets of yellow paper from which the president had just read. Ziegler was pushing. After a full 10 months of a thorough investigation by the Justice Department and putting trust in the people around you, this was just being handled while you were in the process of everything else that happened in 1972. God damn it, in March, when this started coming to you, you can tell by your reactions that you were saying, what in the hell is this going on? And the president interrupted him. I should have reacted before the 21st of March, actually, he said. Dean shouldn't have had to come into me with the cancer in the heart of the presidency, which, to his credit, he did. Yes, that's right, Ziegler replied. He did. Haldeman didn't tell me that. Ehrlichman didn't tell me that. Why had Dean come to him on March 21st? Ziegler assured the president that it was because Dean knew the president was not aware of the problem and of Haldeman and Ehrlichman's involvement in the cover-up. Nixon was exhausted from all those hours of listening to the tapes. They were difficult to hear.
I mean, God, maybe we were talking about a cover-up. Watergate, he said. I really didn't. I didn't know what the hell... I honestly didn't know.
The president asked Ziegler for options, ways to handle the whole Dean problem.
I think we let Dean run his string a little bit, Ziegler answered. At least that's what I'd do at this point, and not respond.
We can't let it run to the point that it hurts us too much, the president said. Not till the 21st of March did he come in and talk about a cover-up.
Ziegler tried to guide him to safer ground, and he did not in any way suggest that he was involved directly, yet...
On the 21st he did, the president corrected Ziegler.
Did he?
He said, even Dean.
But now, the president recalled that he had asked Dean if he knew of the cover-up, and that Dean had denied knowing about it. Nixon and Ziegler were relieved. Ziegler's interpretation would stand. They stumbled on.
I didn't want to burn Mitchell.
That's right, Ziegler agreed.
The key to this thing, Ron, is Mitchell. Always been the key. You haven't had a cover-up. Dean did it. Shit, he didn't do it for Haldeman and Ehrlichman. He did it for John Mitchell. So did Magruder do it for Mitchell. Magruder lied for Mitchell. You know that.
Jeb Stuart Magruder, formerly Haldeman's assistant at the White House, who at the time of the Watergate break-in was deputy director of the Committee for the Re-election of the President.
Sure.
That's the tragedy of the whole thing.
Mitchell would never step up to this.
Well, I suppose would you? No, no. Former Attorney General step up and say you bugged? Shit, I wouldn't.
What I would step up and say,
look, I haven't approved a goddamn thing and so forth, but I take responsibility for it, bah, 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 you know. And I'm gonna take, you know, a suspended sentence or a misdemeanor slapped in the face or whatever the hell it's gonna be. But once denied, under oath, he was stuck, see? Goddamn.
The perjury's the thing, that's the problem, Ziegler agreed. And they continued to attribute the basic cover-up to Dean and his efforts to protect himself and Mitchell.
Dean knew, Ziegler said, firming up their line. Of course he knew it. He knew all of this.
Sure he did.
He knew all of it. He didn't tell me. You hear any of that in here?
No, sir, I can't, said Ziegler.
But you see,
Nixon made another start.
In fairness to Dean, when he mentioned the fact that Strachan was involved, he mentioned the fact that it was not well to let it all hang out, that Ehrlichman might have a problem and so forth. He might well have drawn the conclusion, Ron, that the president wanted him to keep the lid on.
Ziegler was quick to show his boss how to turn the point to his advantage.
Yeah, the political lid in the Irvin Committee hearings, not the legal lid in terms of the trial.
That's the difference I see, said the president.
That's the difference.
Ziegler took the point further. That's the conclusion I had during the whole period, yeah.
We were talking about the Irvin Committee, the president realized.
That's right.
We weren't talking about the trial, said the president. The trial was over.
We were. We were concerned about the Irvin Committee, said Ziegler, and what they would press for in terms, not of illegality, but in terms of political embarrassment. Some...
At last, the president seemed satisfied that he was innocent of the cover-up.
Don't you think it's interesting, though, to run through this? He asked. Really? The goddamn record is not bad, is it?
Makes me feel very good, Ziegler answered.
To the president, that was overstating it a bit.
It's not comfortable for me, because I was sitting there like a dumb turkey.
Ziegler had an answer.
It's a Rashomon theory, he offered.
Hmm?
The president asked.
It's a Rashomon theory, Ziegler tried again. Five men sit in a room, and what occurs in that room, or what is said in that room, means something different to each man,
based upon his perception of the events that preceded it. And that is exactly what this is, exactly what it is. The president grasped the point. Dean perceived that the president was involved in the cover-up based on his own, not Nixon's, special knowledge of what had gone before. It seemed to the president to be a pretty good theory. Perhaps it would hold up. But what about the problem of Dean being a loose cannon?
Suppose Dean goes out and says something, the president asked.
Well, that's why I think we should let Dean run his string, Ziegler suggested, because he's saying so much, or so much is being said for him, that all is becoming so confused and distorted.
They agreed it would be a mistake to respond to each of Dean's statements. Dean was too poised. They would wait him out.
And then he will have to be cracked, Ziegler said, or dealt with in some way which we should determine down the line, you know.
The president appreciated the point. Let Ehrlichman and Haldeman and the rest of them take him on, he said.
Yes, sir, Ziegler agreed.
We've got him dead to rights on that, Ron, haven't we? The president asked.
They discussed Dean's work habits and once again concluded that he was not the type to keep detailed records.
Buzzard had plundered Dean's files on matters other than Watergate and had found no memoranda of conversations.
He hadn't taken them with him. He had never made any.
They had their case. They had a complete record of the president's meetings with Dean. Let him commit himself to his own recollection. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and the rest would destroy him with a more precise version.
We'll survive it all, Ziegler concluded.
Ziegler left, and the president went back to his listening. Later, he summoned Buzzard to his office and explained that he had developed his version of 20 of the key meetings and phone conversations with Dean about Watergate. In much the same exercise he had gone through with Ziegler, Nixon read from his notes, departing from them to make a point, punctuating his reading to reinforce his interpretation. These notes clearly supported him and refuted Dean, Nixon said. Right? Buzzard nodded his agreement and wrote down the subjects that the president said were discussed during each conversation. He was beginning to feel waves of uneasiness. As Nixon read aloud, Buzzard saw the intrinsic contradictions. A great deal didn't make sense. In one meeting, Nixon had been told of Strachan's knowledge of the Watergate operation. And only 1 week later, he heard and appeared to accept that there was not a scintilla of evidence as to any White House involvement. Buzzard kept quiet. The president was about to offer his version of the celebrated March 21st meeting, the meeting in which Dean claimed Nixon said that paying another $1 million to the Watergate conspirators would be no problem.
Haldeman, who had heard the tape, and Nixon, who hadn't, were agreed on the detail.
The president read softly and carefully, his eyes riveted on the yellow legal pad. Dean gave the president his theory of what had happened. He still said no prior June 17th White House knowledge, that Magruder probably knew, that Mitchell possibly knew, that Strachan probably knew, that Haldeman had possibly seen the fruits of the wiretaps through Strachan, that Ehrlichman was vulnerable, that Colson had made a call to Magruder. Buzzard got the message. In other words, almost all the president's key advisers and aides could be implicated. Buzzard jotted furiously on his own legal pad as Nixon read from his notes. Hunt was trying to blackmail Ehrlichman about Hunt's prior plumber activities unless he was paid what ultimately might amount to $1 million. The president said, how could it possibly be paid? What makes you think he would be satisfied with that? Again, that last phrase, in quotes, the president pointed out. Then continuing, the president stated it was blackmail, that it was wrong, that it would not work, that the truth would come out anyway. Dean said Colson had talked to Hunt about executive clemency. The more Nixon read, the more Buzzard realized that John Dean had a case. Nixon saw it differently and wanted everything given to the Republican minority of the Senate Watergate Committee to aid them when they cross-examined Dean. Buzzard passed the information to Fred Thompson, the minority's counsel, that it was wrong. The phrase stuck in Buzzard's mind. The president gave Buzzard little peace, often summoning him to his office on the bellboy the lawyer wore everywhere except in church. The two men were spending a good deal of time together. Refuting Dean on the specifics was not enough, Nixon said. There was a more general problem. The administration's legitimate national security operations were being deliberately entangled by his enemies in Watergate.
those activities had to be separated from the scandal. Nixon said he knew that surreptitious entries and wiretaps, after all, that was what Watergate was all about, wasn't it, were a way of life in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. "I know this has been going on for 20 years. It is the worst kind of hypocrisy for the Democrats to make so much of it." Thinking about stories he had heard on the Hill, Buzzard agreed with the president, but the problem was to document the abuses of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations in the same way that the Irvin Committee was presently calling the Nixon administration to account. Nixon pointed out that he had asked John Dean, of all people, to come up with a list of his predecessor's abuses, but Dean, usually so thorough, hadn't really come up with much. The FBI didn't have records on the blatantly political work done for the Democratic administrations, Buzzard said, and certainly it did not keep records of illegal break-ins. However, he had heard from good FBI sources that congressmen had been tapped during the 1960s.
"Was there any way to prove it?" Nixon wanted to know.
Buzzard was sure there was not. But the FBI did have records of national security taps, and there must have been some abuses. There had to be a way to make the other side pay the price, Nixon said. This was a partisan battle. Dean was going to tell the world about his White House. What he said should be measured against the record of prior administrations. Get a comprehensive list of all the national security wiretaps conducted by the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, Nixon ordered. Call the Attorney General and get the Justice Department started on it now. Buzzard found that Elliot Richardson was reluctant to cooperate. Buzzard therefore took the heat from the president for a while, but eventually he passed it back to Richardson. After the fourth call to the Attorney General, a list came back. It was impressive, as Nixon had predicted. Though incomplete, it was political dynamite, the same kind of taps that had caused Nixon grief. The president might be right, Buzzard concluded. Nixon was elated. There had been hardly a hint in the press, fascinated by the fact that many of the taps had been authorized by former Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy. The president read the list with delight. Lloyd Norman, Pentagon and military affairs correspondent for Newsweek, supposedly ordered by President John F. Kennedy himself because Norman had obtained classified information. Hanson W. Baldwin, military affairs specialist for the New York Times. Robert Amory, Jr., the former number three man in the CIA and a close personal friend of President Kennedy. He had reportedly been a close friend of a Yugoslavian embassy official who was an undercover intelligence officer. The law firm of Suri and Karasik, which had lobbied for Dominican Republic sugar interests and was under investigation for trying to raise the United States sugar quotas. Bernard Fall, the late French historian and author of 7 books on Vietnam, who had interviewed and maintained contact with North Vietnam's president Ho Chi Minh over a period of years. The chief clerk to the House Agriculture Committee, who had worked for Representative Harold D. Cooley, Democrat, North Carolina, after the committee had handled sugar quota legislation. Buzzard was sure there were more taps on the Hill, but they could at least document these. Nixon continued his reading. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., that had been extensively reported. Frank A. Capel, the right-wing author of The Secret Story of Marilyn Monroe, a book published in 1964, which alleged a relationship between Robert Kennedy and the late movie actress. The president chortled. The Capel tap surely didn't sound like a national security matter to him. It confirmed everything he had always suspected about the Kennedys. He could stand on his record. He had taken the extreme action of wiretapping staff and reporters only in cases where secret negotiations were in jeopardy. He was not the sort of man who would tap a writer who had written about his private life. Kennedy's, not Nixon's, did that sort of thing. Could Buzzard get a list of all the illegal break-ins conducted during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations? Buzzard explained again that the agencies were very unlikely to have kept records of blatantly illegal activity. There was just no way he could get a list. "All right," Nixon said. "Leak the Kennedy wiretaps." Buzzard went to Haig. They both thought that leaking the information was too obvious a strategy. Instead, they released, without any names, a statistical summary of national security wiretaps that had been conducted under the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations. It indicated that there had been fewer under Nixon than under his Democratic predecessors. The president was not satisfied. He pushed Buzzard again and again to leak the names of those tapped during the two preceding administrations. It was not a very good idea, Buzzard insisted. It could backfire. It might well appear to be one more use of the FBI files for political advantage. Nixon said he wanted it done. He would not tolerate defiance. He had not asked for Buzzard's opinion. Buzzard and Haig stalled. The president called from California.
Dean was going before the Senate Watergate Committee in a few days.
Nixon was screaming, "I want that out. I haven't read it in the newspaper. I don't want excuses. Do it." Buzzard and Haig conferred. There was also pressure from other senior White House staff members. Anything that happened in this administration happened in spades in others, Haig told selected reporters. He knew very well that there had been a consistent pattern of executive abuse under the Kennedy and Johnson regimes, but he couldn't figure out how to get the message out more specifically. If they leaked the details, they would be pulled ever deeper into a partisan crossfire. There was no way to make the public focus on past administrations, not while the current one was being attacked daily in the press or in some congressional investigation or another. Nevertheless, Haig told Buzzard, he was not sure he or anyone else could control the president on this particular matter. All they could do was stall. When the president got back from California, it was Buzzard who reopened the subject. He laid out his reasoning patiently. It wouldn't do any good. They would be doing exactly what they had accused the Watergate Committee and others of doing. It just wouldn't fly. At last, the president capitulated. But he knew, the staff knew, and the other side knew, that what his people had done was nothing, literally nothing, compared to what had gone on before. They were all innocent. Finally, on June 25th, John Dean appeared in public before the Senate Watergate Committee. He read a 245-page statement that described the Watergate cover-up in elaborate detail. Over the next 4 days, Dean fielded questions adeptly, contradicting the president's versions of events with impressive consistency. His story, basically unshakable, held up as an extended accusation against the Nixon White House, wiretapping, burglary, secret funds, money laundering, enemies lists, dirty tricks, plumbers, physical surveillance, choreographed character assassination, cover-up, obstruction of the federal agencies. But Nixon had been right. Dean's account of the president's participation in the Watergate cover-up rested only on his own recollection of the events. It sounded authentic, but it was legally inconclusive. There was no documentation. Almost in desperation, the Watergate Committee's investigative staff began a series of interviews with so-called satellite witnesses, assistants, secretaries, clerks, and aides who had worked at the White House and for the Committee for the Re-election of the President. These were people who might have seen a memo, overheard a conversation, or kept records that could document Dean's allegations. Each was questioned closely for some small confirmation or denial of the charges against the President. Dean's testimony about pre-Watergate intelligence gathering and political retribution was repeatedly confirmed. But the president had, at least by inference, admitted and justified most of the activities in his statement of May 22nd. The crux of Dean's assertions, the president's direct participation in the cover-up, could not be corroborated. Only 6 relatively minor witnesses remained to be heard before Haldeman and Ehrlichman were to testify. Time was running out for the Watergate Committee. At the White House, things were running according to plan. The president authorized his former chief of staff, Haldeman, to listen to more tapes of White House conversations. Haldeman would be well prepared to undercut Dean's testimony. The threat would soon pass. The temperature was in the 90s in Washington on Friday, July 13th, the day witness Alexander Butterfield was to be interviewed by the Watergate Committee's staff. Room G334 in the new Senate office building had only one small air conditioning vent, and it was oppressively hot. A haze of tobacco smoke obscured the pale yellow walls. The chairs were stained with grease from fast food meals, wastebaskets spilled over with cigarette butts and packages and sandwich wrappings. The faded green carpet was filthy. No janitors had been allowed in for fear that someone might plant an eavesdropping device. Both Butterfield's manner and his memory impressed the committee's junior staff. With his hands folded in front of him, he considered carefully each question that was posed to him. He looked directly at his interrogator. He spoke in calm and even tones. He had resigned his commission as an Air Force colonel to work for Haldeman in the White House. He described precisely and laboriously every aspect of his job as deputy assistant to the president. He seemed to enjoy this rare opportunity to talk about the responsibilities he had been charged with. But his candor and memory were not much help in determining whether it was John Dean or Richard Nixon who was lying. Butterfield's job and his access to the president were matters of routine. He kept the keys and the files. "Did you ever see or hear anything which indicated to you that the president was involved in the alleged effort to keep the facts from the public?" Butterfield was asked. "No, but the way the White House operated, it could have happened, certainly." The witness paused to reflect. "The series of meetings in question, with Dean, didn't begin until February 1973. I was phasing out of my job and getting ready to leave for the FAA. I can't document anything or prove anything. I don't remember Watergate being anything." The staff, trying to make the most of the situation, turned back to Butterfield's expertise on the president's office routine. The minute detail of materials submitted to the committee from Buzzard was puzzling. One memorandum listed the times, dates, locations, and participants for all the Dean-Nixon conversations. Another described the substance of Dean's calls and meetings with the president. "We received a listing from the White House of the conversations between the president and Dean, which we understand are from the president's diaries," a member of the committee's staff said. "We have three types of backup materials from which these listings could be constructed," Butterfield carefully explained. "The switchboard operators kept track of all phone calls to and from the president. Secret Service personnel, ushers, and secretaries record who comes and goes from the president's office. Staff members prepare memos for the president before each formal meeting with outsiders, outline the purpose and points to be covered, and then prepare another memo after each meeting, summarizing the tone of the meetings and any commitments made. All this was put together into a daily log for the president, where, when, and with whom he had met. Would there be a file on the substance of each meeting with staff members? If the staff member was in alone, or only with other White House staff members, there would probably be no memo written. If there was a highly significant meeting, the president might say, 'Write this up.'" Pulling out a typed transcript of the summary that Buzzard had dictated to the Republican Minority Council, the president's version of his conversations with Dean, an investigator asked Butterfield where such an account might have originated. Could it have been from someone's notes of the meetings? Butterfield glanced over the document. He paused several times to remark on how detailed the account was. He appeared to be fascinated by that. He lingered over it. "Somebody probably got the information from the Cron file and put it down," he said finally. As he continued to read, he was asked whether the summary described the kinds of meetings the president would ask someone to write up. "No." Resuming his reading, Butterfield arrived at the account of the March 21, 1973 meeting and stopped. He noted aloud that the summary stated that Dean had told the president that Hunt was trying to blackmail Ehrlichman. Butterfield was surprised. It was he who pointed out to his questioners that the next sentence included an actual quote. "The president said, 'How could it possibly be paid?' Quote, 'What makes you think he would be satisfied with that?'" "Where did you get this?" Butterfield inquired. "Mr. Buzzard provided it to the committee.
Could it have come from someone's notes of a meeting? He was asked. No, it seems too detailed, Butterfield replied.
Was the president's recollection of meetings good?
Yes, when I came I was impressed, Butterfield replied. He is a great and fast learner. He does recall things very well. He tends to over-explain things.
Was he as precise as the summary?
Well, no, but he would sometimes dictate his thoughts after a meeting.
How often did he do so?
Very rarely.
Were his memos this detailed?
I don't think so.
Where else could this have come from?
Butterfield stared down at the document. Slowly, he lifted it an inch off the table.
I don't know. Well, let me think about that a while.
He pushed the document toward the center of the green, felt-covered table. The questioning moved into other areas.
Did the president ever note an article in a news summary and write in the margin?
Yes.
Did he ever write, "Get this guy"?
Yes, not necessarily in those words. He is profane, but in a nice sort of way.
Do you recall when he said, "Get this guy"? Do you remember the phrase he used?